Welcome back to the Power in Market podcast, our editorial roundtable discussion for important news of the week. We have this week Ryan McMakin, senior editor for Mises.org. We have Connor O'Keefe, our weekly Wednesday column writer who does a variety of things, and I am going to be serving as host today, though Bishop. And we have a lot to talk about, a lot to unpack. It's been an eventful week. So let's start with a very interesting story out of New York, interesting from a political point of view, interesting from an economic point of view, interesting for a blackpilling of where America might be going forward. A lot there with the primary victory for Zohran Mamdani, who is a Democrat Socialist aligned candidate, upsetting Andrew Cuomo, one of the towering figures of New York politics for quite some time, vastly outperforming the betting odds, outperforming all traditional logic out there, but sparking now new conversations about the appeal of a more overtly socialist platform. Not that there's not plenty of socialism baked into the American status quo in a variety of angles there. And so I think there's a few different layers of this story to unpack. And let's start with you, Ryan. I know you probably do not care at all about New York City politics in your day-to-day life. But what was your reaction? I know Bill Anderson had an article on The Wire this week about the fallacies of trying to once again bring back socialist ideas or the resurged interest there and the predictable consequences. But what was your first takeaway from learning of Zohran Mamdani's victory? And did you know who Zohran Mamdani was before Tuesday? Is itself a question for you, Ryan.
Well, I mean, I knew who he was because I saw stuff about him on X/Twitter, but I didn't follow it closely. And of course, I didn't doubt for a minute that the guy could be elected in New York City. I mean, I don't know why that would seem impossible at all. I mean, yeah, he clearly has. Now, to reference Bill's article, which is called, by the way, "Will New York City Become the New Socialist Paradise?" At the moment, it's pretty much at the top of Mises.org, Mises.org, in case you haven't been there lately. And Bill, right, notes that, yep, he's far left even by Democratic Party standards. And I mean, I could think you could describe him as a true socialist, right? People throw the term around a lot. This guy's a socialist because he's center left. But Mamdani actually supports real socialism in the sense that he wants government owned means of production, right? He wants government owned grocery stores. He wants totally government controlled enterprises of various types, which is the strict definition of socialism, not just, hey, this guy supports some interventionism we don't like. So even by the standards of your standard New York politician, he's pretty far out there. However, it seemed that from what I saw about his race, he was just running like a standard economic populist race in the sense of, I'm trying to make things cheaper for you, regular people. And a lot of people liked that. However, the other thing that I noticed is that he wasn't especially popular among working class or lower class people. And this, of course, is the time-honored thing we see again and again, right? Who's supporting the farthest left commie sorts of candidates? It's like white people with graduate degrees. It's, in this case, it looked like the number one groups that supported him were whites and Asians, whatever that means, right? That could mean Pakistanis. It could mean Iranians. It could mean Japanese people. In this case, perhaps I would suspect it's a lot of South Asians were in favor of this. But also, a thing about those two groups is that they tend to be the groups with the largest number of college-educated people. And looking at that, not shocking, I suppose. That's who sees an ad about how we need to make fattoush cheap again or whatever. And they're like, ah, yes, I want to help the common man, so I will vote for this commie. Meanwhile, actual Hispanics and blacks are like, especially Hispanics, right, who tend to have jobs like in the private sector. Many are small business owners, that sort of thing. They're like, I don't want a commie. And so you saw some of the smallest amount of support coming out of blacks and Hispanics for this guy. So yet again, and actually Bill Anderson has made this point. I don't know that he makes it in the article, but he's made this point many times. Hey, if you want to deport the people that are turning America communist, deport people with graduate degrees from American universities, right? Deport white people with too much college. Those are the people turning this country commie. And that seems to be what's going on in New York City as well. So not a whole lot of surprises. I suppose it seems to be going the way that I would regard your standard sort of left-controlled American city to go. I think I'll just be very interested to see how the overall election goes, to see just how much this guy wins. If he wins by a big landslide as he did in the Democratic primary, well, that is some true black pilling. And I don't know, will the Republican get any votes in this case? And what about Adams, the incumbent? I don't know. It could offer some surprises still, or maybe, as of course people are freaking out or saying, oh, New York's just going to end up like London, which I would think is maybe bad, but we'll see going forward.
How about you, Connor? What were your takeaways from this important race, since everything revolves around New York City politics?
That's right. Yeah, well, I agree with a lot of what you're saying there, Ryan. I did find the breakdown to be very interesting, and really it's just sort of the same old story, like what you were talking about. It's like the white college-educated people that are not actually going to be very affected by what he was running on that are the ones that carried him to victory in this primary. And I think that's interesting. I think that's a big that is a small slice of what is a much bigger phenomenon in this country, where a lot of people that are really, or at least voters that are determining what gets done in this country, are the people that only engage with politics sort of as a hobby, almost, like, and it's just a way for them to feel good about themselves. Whereas the actual poor people that are, you know, allegedly going to be the ones receiving, you know, the various programs he ran on, and the very rich people that are going to be taxed for it, were both voting for Cuomo a lot more than they were for Zohran. And I don't know, I think that's interesting. Like, you know, obviously the very rich are probably not happy about their already crazy high taxes going up. But I imagine that for the very poor, too, these are the people that already have a lot of experience with, you know, the city trying to help with these various programs. They probably see on the ground that, you know, these fantasies about, like, oh, if we just open a few government managed grocery stores, then, like, essentially all these problems are going to go away. Like, they're going to be a lot more aware of how unrealistic that is than the person that's just kind of engaging with this as a hobby. But I guess what I've been, and I didn't follow this race super closely, I did see some of his campaign material. I was overall impressed. You know, he's like a young, charismatic guy. And yeah, like, he, I guess, identifies as a democratic socialist, not a fan of socialism. He's had some comments in the past, like in the past few years, that have sort of resurfaced that, like, seem very kind of hardcore on the identitarian side. But he seems to have dropped that. It seemed like people are calling it a post-woke left campaign, and I think that was accurate. He essentially was going around filming these social media videos talking just about how absurd the cost of living in New York is, which is true, and then just sort of floating out different ideas that, you know, sound a little different than we're used to, sound a little clever. And yeah, and then he was, he won, I think, on that. I think that's sort of a common sense thing to run on, especially if you're going to be in Manhattan, where the cost of living is just, it's crazy there. But the reaction, I think, especially from the right, has been kind of disappointing. This is something we touch on often. They've sort of, like, the most right-wing, or the most common right-wing response I'm seeing is sort of talking about, you know, how this is a Muslim, and you have people talking about how, like, oh, you know, it was Charlie Kirk or Matt Walsh, like, we're talking about how, like, 9/11 happened, and then fast forward a few years, and there's, like, a young Muslim mayor there, or, like, was it Marjorie Taylor Greene, like, put out some post with, like, the Statue of Liberty and, like, a niqab or something like that. And it's just, like, that I think is completely missing the point, in large part because, like, it was the white middle class people that actually elected this guy. There would maybe be something to that, this sort of general immigration point they're making, that, like, you know, Muslims are taking over New York, now they've elected one of their own. Like, okay, maybe you can make that argument if the actual, like, voter breakdown supported that, but it kind of goes the opposite direction in this case. And I guess it just kind of, it comes back to this broader issue I have, where the right has really ceded this whole topic of cost of living to the left. And I think that is completely unnecessary. Obviously, that is something we talk about a lot. But, like, yeah, like, he had this one video where he was going around to different, halal stands and talking about how, and, like, interviewing these guys. And they were talking about how just terrible the permitting system is there. It's just, like, pure cronyism. And it's just, like, this very basic, like, oh, well, we should do away with that. And then all this, like, street food is going to get a lot cheaper. And it's like, that does not, the extreme left does not have to have a monopoly on those kinds of points. And the right just is so often refusing to talk about that. And then they'll kind of go with, like, their sort of whatever kind of culture war topic they feel like talking about without actually, like, really jumping in and engaging with, like, the facts on the ground. And I just think that's such a disappointing thing, you know, from my perspective as somebody that is not a fan of democratic socialism, not a fan of the specific programs that this guy is putting out there. And I wish there was more, like, productive backlash, I guess.
Well, and you make they mentioned that it's like a post-woke thing, but it's also a pre-woke thing, right? Like, the, you know, the mid-century left would, of course, double down on economic populism and wanted to send the message that they were making the cost of living better for everybody. And then they lost track of that. And I know the old left guys that I would play poker with and stuff for a period of years, they saw it coming and they would pound the drum and say again and again, guys, you got to get back, Democratic Party friends, you got to get back to economic populism. You got to talk about making life cheaper for people, make life easier for people. Instead, you're spending all this time saying how we need to put more men in women's locker rooms and stuff like that. And they overplayed that hand massively and they lost. And so it sounds like Zorob is getting a clue and saying, hey, I want to make life easier and cheaper for you. And a lot of people like that, because it's not like he got no votes from the lower middle class or the working class, something like that. He did okay there. It certainly wasn't his base of support. Meanwhile, yeah, the Republicans are, like, obsessing over Islam. And I would say that's one of the...
Do you fear Sharia law in New York City, Ryan?
Well, that's the thing. Is nothing about this guy is... he's not Saudi, so it's not like he's pushing this stuff. And he knows better than to do that. I think he's too politically savvy to do that. And so the right is now, you're right, the right is obsessing with the culture war rather than saying, hey, we offer a better alternative for small business people than these guys. And I think you're right. If he continues to go down that road and the right continues to mess up like that, then, yeah, continue to see. People are going to learn from this, right? Other candidates in other cities are going to say, oh, yeah, maybe I could win using the same policy. And if a bunch of Republicans just say, nope, we're just going to obsess over immigrants only, I don't think that's going to end well for the Republicans.
Of course, you could have a whole other conversation about, is Sharia law preferable over the current legal system of New York? But probably bad for the banking sector there. But I think that's kind of one of the surprising takeaways I have, is the extent to which his campaign was clearly focused on these kind of economic material arguments. There's kind of this broader thing, like, you know, you have people pushing, like, this abundance agenda, like Ezra Klein has a book, and people are trying to interject that from, like, a more centrist left sort of perspective. And so here you have someone from the left kind of take it. But the fact that it didn't resonate that much with the working class sort of neighborhoods, I mean, it's interesting if you break it down by, like, the most the more homogenous ethnic neighborhoods. Cuomo won in the black community, which was not particularly so surprising. The Hispanic community, even the Asian community. So, like, the more ethnic conclaves that you have in New York City, the more homogenous populations were the ones less interested in the sort of bright-eyed socialist, despite the fact that his campaign was focused on that. One of the other interesting, like, this historical tidbits about Mamdani in particular is he's basically the product of a failed CIA operation. Like, his father, who was a Columbia Marxist professor, an explicitly Marxist professor, literally is part of the Kennedy African Airlift, which is a whole scheme to, like, plop up African students bring them to the United States, train them in our universities, and then send them back to create like a pro-American political class, which, I mean, ended up creating a whole bunch of American Marxists rather than Soviet Marxists, so we can have a whole other conversation. There you go, CIA. Another win from that background. So that whole thing is just kind of just amusing in its own right. But his campaign in particular, the social media ads, the way he talked about these issues, it's going to be interesting to see, as Connor, you mentioned, the extent to which this is seen as a viable platform going forward. You're already having a lot of capitulation from Democrat power brokers who have been trying to kind of keep an arm's distance a bit from like the AOC generic squad sort of crowd within the Congressional caucus. But to me, I think a part of this aspect is that when we think about political systems, and we've had like the uniparty dominance for quite some time, Trump shook up the Republican Party in various ways, obviously a strong economic populist dynamic there. The Democrat Party really hasn't changed, so it's become sort of the last bastion for neoconservatives and sort of political status quoers. To me, I think we're starting to see the Democratic Party become more AOC, more Mamdani, not reflected in leadership because from their cold, dead hands will you take the influence of Schumer and Pelosi. We'll see if AOC runs against Schumer. Could be interesting there. But like, you know, I could see this being the start of the Democratic Party shifting its ideology more overtly in this direction and maybe creating a lot more of an ideological polarization in the party structure, which could have a lot of interesting things going forward there. But Ryan, I know you had some comments on the idea of poaching elites from outside places and trying to use colonization platforms. All of which are leading, perhaps as successful as bringing in the father of Mamdani to the United States.
Well, kind of referring back to that whole thing about deporting the graduate school educated white people as the real source of hardcore socialism. This is actually true internationally, right? When you look at where did the Marxists come from in the third world, right? That occurred in the mid 20th century. You saw all these like commie movements in like sub-Saharan Africa and Latin America. And what you found was a lot of that was the product of efforts by Western European countries to educate elites from these colonized countries. The British are notorious for this, right? They bring in local elites from their colonized countries. They bring them into London. They educate them in quote unquote Western ways. But what Western ways means is, hey, we're going to teach you all about Lenin and Marx. So what happens is that these people then go back to their home countries and they were taught how to be commies by the British ruling class. And I, of course, then thought of that because of what you're saying about CIA program. And right, I mean, the Americans do the same thing, right? Oh, well, here, let's educate foreigners. Let's teach them our ways by putting them through our graduate schools. And then they leave as communists. And then we're all supposed to believe that the locus of communism comes from, quote unquote, like lower class or brown people or whatever from these other countries. They're all introduced to Lenin and Marx by graduate school university white people. So the phenomenon spreads. And that's apparently the CIA is trying to do its best to mimic the British ruling class from about 100 years ago, which used very similar methods before. But one more thing on this topic, too. I haven't like looked into it in depth, but one thing that someone was grasping for something good coming out of this election in New York, and they pointed out, they said, well, one thing that should be acknowledged is that the Dems, the establishment Dems in this, and especially Cuomo, had tried to make the election a referendum on the state of Israel, in the sense that Cuomo was big time doubling down on the whole Israeli thing, and probably did a ton of fundraising along those lines, and it turned out to not be a help at all. And so that's going to be a lesson for a lot of people moving forward within the Democratic Party as well, is that maybe a lot of bootlicking of Israeli supporters isn't going to get you either money, or at least certainly not enough money you need to get elected. So that's something there that should be noted, although we'll know more moving forward.
Well, it'll be interesting to see how that plays out in a general, like that's another aspect of it. Like turnout in the Democratic primary was pretty low. So like the idea that there's some sort of uplifting of like new inspired voters because of like this bright and sexy young campaign. I don't think that really shows itself. But obviously, the Israel issue in particular, I think, is going to be one of the at the forefront. So I'll be interested to see that, you know, how that really plays out. I mean, there's definitely a generational gap there that I think it's amazing how people are not picking up on that. Like, maybe talking about New York issues rather than Israeli issues might actually work out better in a New York City election. Yeah, we'll see how that plays out there. But it is glad, you know, that Cuomo did suffer defeat after, again, he turns out, you know, you can not only kill so many people's grandparents and then expect to be politically rewarded, even in a city, even a place like New York City. So that's the very least, it's good to see bad guys lose.
Yeah, you're right. That's something I didn't think about. It could be like COVID, post-COVID blowback still. I mean, maybe that was an effect. So if so, that's a white pill, I suppose.
And just a general like anti-establishment thing. I mean, I don't think you could get more establishment for New York City mayor than Cuomo. So yeah, it's like, it's good to see. And I was talking earlier about the reaction from the right, but the reaction from like the establishment left and the Democrats has also been just atrocious. And I think a lot of that comes down to the fact that, like, the way I look at all this is these people spend all of their time just denying that there are any downsides whatsoever to government intervention in various parts of the economy. And then, you know, for no real reason, they are, you know, they'll claim they're against democratic socialism, but they give no real reason. As like, they'll never find themselves talking about like the downsides of having a $30 minimum wage or whatever. It's always, you know, going against the Republican talking points. And I just look at, like, you know, the young generation that I think this guy to some extent represents. Are there just people that are like, okay, well, if it's really true that the government can like eliminate poverty, like, what are we waiting for? And they don't, the current establishment Democratic Party has no counter to that, because the only counter to that is like the sound economics that they spend all of their time attacking. And so I think that they're going to have to change something here if they don't want to completely lose credibility. This does seem to have been some kind of a wake-up call, but it seems like they're trying to take more of a co-option strategy, like, oh, we've been, you know, with this guy the whole time. I could see them kind of going that path, but it's just going to be a very interesting thing to watch. And this is just an interesting little like microcosm that I think it's like, it's the first post-Trump victory electoral data we're getting. And, you know, the trends are changing right now. And this is just a little window into that.
Yeah, the Democrats that view public schools as a sacred institution in America, freaking out about Mondani's proposals to have government grocery stores. Surprised that did not resonate more with Democrat voters. right there. Moving on to something that definitely involves New York, but of course involves everyone, is now with the news cycle resetting a bit from Middle East Watch, Fed criticism back as a mainstream talking points. We've had J.D. Vance tweeting about it. We see Trump raging about it. We see a number of Republicans start taking up the banner going after Jay Powell's job. And that is obviously, we touched on last week, the Fed's refusal to budge, to follow Trump's edicts in terms of further cutting interest rates, bringing up all sorts of different conversations about, you know, where's the direction of the Fed going to go? Ryan, what has been your takeaway from the, again, always good to see Fed criticism in the news, even if the direction of policy may not be wanted, but glad to see at least more arrows being thrown in the direction of the Fed, even if they might not be our arrows. But what's your broader takeaway here?
Well, of course, it's good that the Fed is not seen as above criticism or some sort of holy institution can't criticize. But of course, when you see what the Trump administration is doing these days, J.D. Vance, Trump himself, and now what we've got is his FHFA guy, the guy who heads up Fannie and Freddie, Bill Pulte, of the Pulte home construction fortune. As one guy on one wag, as we say on Twitter, put it, Bill Pulte is yet another rich guy born on third base who thinks he hit a triple. Born into money. He got rich on owning assets, has spent his whole life begging for low interest rates, more bailouts, so that people who already own assets get even richer, while people who don't own a lot of assets get poorer. And so Pulte's just part of that group. We want lower interest rates. We want more monetary stimulus. He sees no downside to it because he got rich just being rich. And of course, the Fed has always helped that. But these criticisms coming out of him and out of Vance and stuff, it's not real criticism, because all they're saying is that the Fed's not doing enough of what the Fed has always done, which is inflate devalue the currency, create new bubbles. They're not doing enough of that to suit J.D. Vance. Vance's monetary policy is basically indistinguishable from that of Ben Bernanke or that of Janet Yellen. He may even be worse. I don't know. But all they want is more of the same, and Powell isn't doing enough of it. So what you get are tweets like, well, this is from J.D. Vance saying that, gee, Powell, he cut the interest rate leading up to the election in the fall of last year when unemployment was actually better. Why isn't he cutting the rate now when unemployment is worse and inflation is lower now? He should be cutting more. And the reality, of course, is that he shouldn't have cut back in fall. That was probably politically motivated. And it turned out the Fed was wrong. The Fed, in order to justify their rate cut back then, claimed that the inflation rate was rapidly moving back to its 2% made up, totally arbitrary target. And it wasn't. It's still not back there. Here we are 7 months later. So they shouldn't have cut back then, but they shouldn't cut now. They should just do nothing. Rather than blow up the next bubble, in terms of historical averages, there's nothing wrong with the current interest rate. It's pretty humdrum. It's pretty standard. It's pretty average. So this idea that the Fed is holding interest rates high, which first of all, the Fed isn't doing. The Fed allowed the interest rate to tick up because if there were actually market rates, they would be probably much higher than they are. So the Fed was simply taking less action in terms of printing new money and forcing down interest rates. So the Fed was being more laissez-faire. And of course, Vance and Trump hate that. Oh, too much free markets and interest rates right now. We need the Fed to get in there and print more money and force down interest rates some more. And that's what Pulte is saying as well. And then in the process, he's saying, well, if Powell doesn't force down interest rates some more, he should resign. And so all these people, right, if you love Janet Yellen, then you'll like Trump's monetary policy as well. If you like Biden-era monetary policy, well, then you'll love what J.D. Vance wants to shove down your throat, because that's just what they want from Powell. It's just the standard garbage. And so now they're talking about replacing him. Okay, fine. I guess that just means someone who's slightly more inflationist than Powell. And by the way, the fact that I'm kind of defending Powell from Vance and Trump, I wouldn't call it a defense, just that Powell's just not being as bad as he could be right now. And Trump wants him to be worse. So that's what the story is with monetary policy right now. These so-called capitalists in the Trump administration want more Fed intervention. They want more easy money. They want more money printing. And they want artificially low interest rates so their pals on Wall Street can continue to experience asset price inflation while normal people, first-time homebuyers, continue to get screwed. That is the Trump policy. Screw first-time homebuyers. Screw regular people who don't own a lot of assets already, so my buddies on Wall Street can continue to get rich. That's the Pulte position. That's the J.D. Vance position. And I don't know why I keep seeing places where MAGA people keep acting like, well, of course Trump is right. He's just trying to free the economy. I'm like, what are you talking about? I guess they heard somewhere on some pro-Trump podcast that the Trump position on monetary policy is the free market position is totally garbage. I suspect a lot of these people don't know the difference between the Federal Reserve and Federal Express, right? I mean, there's like kind of these low-level MAGA people who have never even heard of the Fed before a few months ago. But now suddenly they're masters of monetary policy and they think Trump has hit upon the right monetary policy. So you're just going to keep getting more inflation, and both sides are terrible. And so if they replace Powell, so what? It's not going to mean anything. All it's going to mean is that Trump is asserting some more control over the Fed, which isn't necessarily good or bad, but it's certainly nothing to get excited about either.
You felt guilty for saying something somewhat defensive of Jay Powell. I have to admit, I have to say one nice thing about Bill Pulte. I did see that he's trying to bring in crypto holdings as something that can be considered for your mortgage consideration. So yeah, there's something positive there. Connor, do you have any admissions of conflicted opinions on any of these figures that you would like to confess to our audience today?
Well, I think I benefit from the fact that I don't follow these individuals as closely. So no, I don't even really know who Pulte is, I'll confess. So no conflicting feelings there. But I feel like what you're talking about here, Ryan, is in a lot of ways, it's kind of just another example of the point I was just making. I think if you think back to like the pandemic, especially, like the mainstream narrative when it comes to the pandemic monetary policy was that because of these crazy, unprecedented circumstances, they were forced to print a tremendous amount of money, and there were no downsides to that whatsoever. They just completely denied and continue to deny. And, you know, you might catch them making small comments about how, like, oh, the inflation may have been related. But it, certainly when we were in the thick of it, they were denying it. It was transitory. It was because of supply shocks. And it's just, so it's kind of the same dynamic where, like, okay, yeah, we're seeing it from J.D. Vance and, like, the Trump administration right now because they're in power. But I suspect you'd get a lot of the same stuff from the people on the far left where it's like, okay, if there was no downside to doing that, to this historic, you know, Fed support that we got, then, like, why aren't we doing this all the time? I remember there was a there was an article, I guess actually it was a book from the New York Times Fed watcher. I can't remember her name off the top of my head, but she wrote a book about this, you know, not from our perspective at all. It was sort of, she was framing it as a mystery. And it was this, just this idea that, like, well, if the Fed, you know, because, and I don't really remember the specifics too well off the top of my head, but the Fed went a lot further when it came to, like, giving direct support to small governments, to, you know, members of the economy than, you know, in the past they had used other, there had been, like, a progression, but they had used ways of sort of getting the money eventually to the economy. And it, with the pandemic, they were just a lot more direct. And then obviously the scale of it was on a whole other level. And she sort of wrote this book that, you know, I read the article summary that she put out, and it was kind of like, well, this is, I think she called it, like, the Fed opening Pandora's box. Like, well, if this is possible going forward and the Fed can just do this and essentially print money and just give it out and it helps the economy, then, like, is there any limit to this? Was sort of like her big question. Like, that's the big mystery. Like, yes, there are in fact limits to that. That is what we spend a lot of our time talking about. This is all untrue. But that kind of mainstream narrative that gets pushed denies that to a large extent. And then, like, so I guess I don't find it surprising then when the people that are not firmly in our camp when it comes to monetary policy, are they just sort of, they accept that and say, well, then great. Like, then there really is no reason the only reason they could not be doing this right now is to hurt Trump. And it's like, well, that is not the most unbelievable thing in the world. But I guess it's just, it's another version of the public schools to government-owned grocery stores, but with monetary policy.
Are you talking about Gina Smialek's book, Limitless? Yeah, Limitless. The Federal Reserve takes on a new age of crisis. This, I think it's from last year. Gina Smialek. I think she says Smialek. It's another one of those books, right? You see quite a few of these books. Panderer to Power was one that came about 10 years ago. It was about Greenspan. And right. these are good financial journalism books that relate all the weird stuff that central banks are doing. By weird, I mean bad. But they don't have, like, a theoretical grounding, right? Because they're financial journalists and they're not really interested in the academic side of things very much. They just kind of interview people and tell a story and repeat what experts tell them. You know, experts, quote unquote, guys like Powell. Again, it's an interesting book. It's got, like, lots of valuable facts in there. But yeah, you're right. I never really kind of thought about the way you put it is that, well, I mean, they just, what reason do they have to push back against the story that is communicated to them from these institutions? Because they don't have an alternative framework, theoretically. And so, yeah, that is always the limit of these sorts of books, is that the factual information is useful, but in the end, the conclusions are usually useless, and it's just not very helpful in sort of framing any sort of worldview, because everybody is looking out there and saying, wow, these central banks are so just totally out of control and are doing so much stuff that nobody would have ever thought even remotely acceptable, say, 20 years ago. And so why not just do more of it, right? Why not just do more? And I don't think there's ever an answer to that question. So if you're some guy who doesn't understand economics at all, like J.D. Vance or Donald Trump, and you just see that the Fed's doing this stuff now, your only framework is political. Well, they did this thing during Biden, so why don't they do it during me? Because number go up during Biden, so I guess it will go up now if the Fed does the same thing, and that's just their only framework for looking at all of that.
Well, Ryan, do you remember where you were 15 years ago?
What was that, 2010? Yeah. I guess I was a housing economist back then. Yeah.
Well, but that's the thing, though. Your memory is better than mine. I can't tell you where I was 15 years ago. but that's the whole thing, though. It's been 15 years since we've had like these current rates. I think a lot of the pressure is coming from, like, I remember when I was on the Hill, one of the few gems of wisdom I got from Barney Frank is that he would talk about how the most powerful political lobby in America are realtors. Because there's a ton of realtors in every single congressional district. They're well organized. They've got a lot of power. And so, like, we haven't, I mean, for 15 years, like, the even though in the grand scheme of things, like, these are perfectly normal interest rates, like, this goes to, like, the psychological and the cultural consequences of normalizing this sort of policy that everyone's become addicted to it. And so, like, that's the issue, is that people don't know how to deal with it. I mean, like, you know, you've got generation of traders. J.D. Vance was 25 years old the last time that we've seen rates the way they are, you know, last year now. And so, like, it's just completely, like, their entire conception of how to even think about this sort of stuff. Again, if you don't appreciate just the extent to which low interest rates, all the structural damage that it causes, is that, you know, it's like talking about what's happening in the you know, 1800s, basically, 15 years ago for a lot of people now. It is interesting as well. One other note, Connor, I know you mentioned that you saw, like, a Wall Street Journal article talking about who the next Federal Reserve chairman is going to be. You know, we have our own form of criminology with the Fed. Like who are the Fed governors that are trying to position to parlay the attacks on Powell into, like, their next position? I saw that Chris Waller, who was a Trump appointee couple of years ago, he's one of the people on the Fed kind of signaling, yeah, maybe July is when we need to start looking at these cuts. So it will be interesting to see who comes next.
Well, the question is, what should the Fed be doing, right? So at Mises.org, right, we have our Austrian diehards. They want to know, what should the Fed be doing? Now, of course, our real diehards are like, abolish the Fed, right? Okay, great, good. All in favor of that. But what do you do between where we are and abolishing it, right? Aren't there any medium-term changes we can make? Of course there are. One is to just stop meddling in the interest rate. This is something that's been pointed out. It's like, look, if they just stop changing the interest rate constantly, the markets will adjust. People will adjust their expectations. The markets could function at most interest rates, right? Just stop meddling in it. It will adjust to the real market rate over time. Because remember, the Fed doesn't just, like, set interest rates. This is, of course, the language that people like Vance and Trump use, is they haven't set the interest rate low enough, or they set the interest rate high. That's not how that works. The Fed creates money. They use open market operations, which involves newly created money, to force down interest rates below market levels. That's what they're doing when it's low. And then they back off a little bit, and then the interest rate gets higher. So the laissez-faire position in our current context, I mean, there are conceivably contexts where the market rate would be lower than whatever the Fed's doing, but that's certainly not the world we're living in right now. And so if the Fed backs off, then the interest rate tends to rise. So if you're in favor of markets, you're going to let that interest rate rise. So the Fed could just simply do nothing. And that's what they should be doing. Let the market seep a little bit into the financial sector instead of the constant meddling. And that's one thing they should be doing.
Well, and I think something that's going, that is a string out there, is, like, one of the big changes to Fed policy after 08 was the payment on excess reserves at the Fed. And then during COVID, they eliminated the concept of excess reserves. And so now they're just paying for all the reserves parked at the Fed by primary banks. And so, like, I mean, literally the Treasury is paying out as a subsidy to banks not to lend out money. And so, like, if we're looking for, like, you know, what's that sort of populist sort of angle that could severely damage some of the main tools the Fed has to intervene in this sort of thing? Ted Cruz, I mean, I know we talked a lot about Ted Cruz last week on unrelated issues there, but I know he's sort of starting to drum this beat about the Fed ending the payment on those reserves to the banks. I think that's something that I'm going to be interested to see if that is a point, because that goes to some of, I think, Alex Pollock's concerns about, like, the amount of red ink that the Fed has right now and all that sort of stuff. Is just like this. There's a lot of very interesting, you know, the way the Fed is conducting policy on top of the damages. Like, they have a whole different tool chest going on right now in the way they're doing things that is so radical relative to where we were 15 years ago.
Yeah, don't forget that a huge amount of income going into major commercial banks is coming directly from the Fed in terms of the interest paid on these reserves. It's a huge corporate welfare program. And so, yeah, scale back on that, get some like actual market pricing in there. The thing is, nobody knows how much any of this stuff would cost in an actually functioning market. And I'm not like doing some true Scotsman thing here. I'm not saying unless the market's completely 100% laissez-faire, we can't say we have any sort of capitalism. I'm not saying that at all. What I'm saying is some capitalism where the prices aren't being constantly adjusted by central planners at the central bank would be a good thing. That would be great. And, you know, one way to just nip that in the bud without even having to get rid of the Fed is something that Joe Salerno has mentioned on more than one occasion, is just take away the ability of the central bank to buy assets. Just take away their ability to, to buy up MBSs, to buy up a bunch of government debt. Then we would find out real quick where the market is in terms of reality and what assets are really worth. And all that's just like one little tiny change in the statute. And that would be amazing. And the Fed could still exist. It could actually even still be a lender of last resort, since I know a lot of Fed critics who aren't real Austrians. They say we need, you know, the good old days when the Fed was just the lender of last resort. Those good old days never really existed, as we can see in the work of Jonathan Newman and others. Nevertheless, okay, I'll grant you that. Fine. We'll fight the rest of that battle later. How about we just take away its ability to buy assets? And, of course, all these people like Bill Pulte, who, of course, want constant corporate welfare, they would be totally against that idea. They, of course, want the Fed buying up assets to feather their bed and their friends on Wall Street in terms of home prices, and also to keep interest rates low for more government borrowing. So there, if you have a question, right, in the comments section, like, well, what should the Fed be doing? There you go. Right there. Those are two things. The Fed should just be doing less, should be manipulating interest rates less, and should stop buying assets of any kind ever. Those are some great things. We don't even have to talk about abolishing the Fed yet. But of course, naturally, Washington's vehemently opposed to such reforms as that.
Well, something else that Washington has a reflexive instinct against is peace. We talked last couple episodes about everything going on in Iran. Now we've got the excellent branding of the 12-day war and the ceasefire that was a little iffy there for a second, and now is coming to play. Again, we've looked at a few different angles from this, but did feel like we needed to do what is hopefully a wrap-up. Hopefully nothing will spark tomorrow. You never know in the when it comes to some of these particular actors involved in all this sort of stuff. So Ryan, do you remember, actually, we'll start with you, Connor. Connor, do you remember where you were when the Great Peace came this week?
I think I was in the middle of writing my article on Monday. Yeah, so I didn't have to pivot too much.
I love when that happens.
I was writing a very evergreen kind of big picture article about war, but I had to change some of the details at the beginning of the piece. But I mean, I that was good to see. Like, I'm pro ceasefire. And when you were like, if we go back a week, this was kind of the best we could have hoped for. Iran responded to the strikes that Trump ordered in Iran on some of their nuclear sites with a very symbolic de-escalatory barrage of, I think they sent like six missiles, and they told Qatar, which is telling the U.S. that they're coming. Like, this was clearly just an optics thing. So domestically, they could say, hey, we responded, and you know, look at that, Trump didn't fire back. It gave all three parties, the U.S., Israel, and Iran, the ability to stop and, you know, turn to their domestic populations and, you know, frame themselves as these big winners. Which is good, but there was a great article today or yesterday in the American Conservative, I think by Andrew Day, just pointing out that this is a very unstable piece here. And yes, this may be able to hold. I mean, hopefully, I hope it holds for a very long time. But if you just look at the facts on the ground, especially where negotiations were left and how any future negotiations, if they happen, will be impacted, I think the big point that a lot of people are making and that we were making right after it happened 2 weeks ago was just how much Trump's or the trust that the Iranians must have in Trump has decreased since he turned around and said, oh, you know, I was scheduling these negotiations earlier in the month it was part of the ruse. It was all a deception so that the Israeli strike on Iran could be super effective. It's like, okay, like, yeah, I think I am convinced by some of the reporting. You sent a really good one to the two of us, though, from the New York Times about that, you know, getting into the specifics of like what was happening in the Trump White House with their calls with Netanyahu and the Israelis in the lead up. And yeah, it does seem like, no, Trump actually didn't want this. He wasn't completely caught off guard by it. He knew, you know, hours before, maybe a day or two before, but he still, regardless of all of that, pivoted and presented himself as being behind it. You know, he said, we are controlling the skies over Tehran. And, you know, was bragging about how he helped deceive the Iranians and they never saw it coming. And some reporting says that basically he pivoted once he saw how good the coverage of these strikes were on Fox News, which is a bit concerning if the hosts on Fox News are sort of essentially indirectly driving our foreign policy. That's not something that makes me feel very good about our trajectory. But yeah, so it's hard to see how I can't see them just picking negotiations up where they stopped. And hopefully they're able to find some way to cobble something together that, you know, doesn't involve going back to war. But I'm not very I don't feel very good when I look out in the medium and long range, you know, into the future here.
Well, it certainly hurt negotiations when Iran or when Israel like targeted like most of the people involved directly in the Iran negotiations went the first night. That's yeah, funny how that happens. Ryan, any thoughts?
Well, the thing is I just don't know what I can believe coming out of any of these statements, right? It's what percentage of this is lies? It's probably a mixture of truth and lies is the worst. That's the that's the hardest to figure out in many cases. Yeah, and I'm open to like some good interpretations of this. I mean, I hope that maybe Trump was going his own way and not taking just total orders from the state of Israel on this. I mean, when I saw him declare, right, this, the bombs go out, and then he declares that it's been a total unmitigated success, and it's all completely gone. And they don't even have any enriched uranium left and everything. I mean, that's probably all just made up nonsense. But I liked that he was saying that because it seemed like no more action required on Israel for years and years. And I thought, hey, that's actually pretty good if that's the actual outcome. So maybe that was something he came up with on his own, because it seems like I don't know why the state of Israel would ever want any sort of position that says, yeah, problem solved. Now we're not going to take any action against Iran for the next 5 or 10 years. That I can't imagine Tel Aviv wanting that at all. One other thing, though, that I observed as best I could was that the military part of this conflict did not seem to be great for Israel in terms of all of those missiles that rained down on Tel Aviv. And everything I saw showed that had they continued with that barrage, it wouldn't have been long before they finally overwhelmed and exhausted Israel's missile defense systems, right? That requires a lot of high-tech machinery and missiles. And who's producing that? The Americans aren't producing that at nearly enough of a rate to replace what's being used up, because the Israelis have stockpiled so many of these missiles for such a long time that they were just raining down on Tel Aviv and other locations. And it wasn't going to be long before all of those Iron Dome missiles were simply used up, and the U.S. had no capacity to replace them. So I assume the Americans are back at work trying to replace them as fast as they can. But if Israel can replace its missiles faster, what it means is that Israel is actually winning that arms race of sorts, that conventional arms race, because if they're getting that stuff from their own system, they're getting them from maybe the components from the Chinese and the Russians and stuff. Those countries have a lot of war-making capacity in terms of conventional warfare that the U.S. simply does not have and has not attempted to put any money into, because the U.S. is obsessed with basically corporate welfare for Raytheon, which means like super high expense, small number of weapons like the F-35. And so building artillery, building missiles hasn't been a priority, and they simply don't have the capability to crank those out. So I wonder if Israel really did want at least a temporary ceasefire here as well, so that they could figure out what they were going to do about their missile defense systems. At any rate, I certainly wouldn't declare it tactically some huge, because I don't think that their nuclear capability in Iran was completely destroyed. And the Russians have already signaled that, hell yeah, we'll help them with their non-nuclear capabilities. We'll help them get uranium. We'll help them with their nuclear power plants, all that sort of stuff, which, of course, over time increases your capability to actually produce nuclear weapons. And countries have a right to produce nuclear power and to enrich uranium up to levels that are useful for nuclear power. This is all part of international treaty. And the only reason we act like the Iranians aren't even allowed to do that is because of the state of Israel. But I also saw finally some good research, and I need to get, just dive more into this too. And we brought up this a little bit as well, is how people are starting to see some of the similarities between this situation and the Pakistani situation, how the Americans are kind of remembering that, oh yeah, we opposed Pakistani nukes back in the late 90s, and then they got nukes and we never said anything about it ever again, which just illustrates, right, when the Iranians finally do get nukes, which is inevitable, which they're going to do, it's just going to become much more of a non-issue. And the same people who told us the Pakistanis were too crazed Muslim, were too much of crazed Muslims to have nukes, they told us that back in 1998, and then they shut up about it. I suspect the same thing is going to happen after the Iranis get it. We won't hear about how insane they are. And by the way, this whole conflict has shown how eminently sane the Iranians are in terms of, oh, let's tell the Americans where we're going to send some missiles before we send them so we can minimize American casualties and all that. If they were insane, they would invite a war with the Americans. If they all wanted to die and go to their 72 virgins or whatever, as the right wing tells us is all that motivates them, then of course they would have wanted to start World War III with the Americans immediately. But it seems that they have no interest in that whatsoever. So I think a little bit of information has come online through all of this, but I just don't know what to make of it.
Well, now the concern is New York City going to get nuclear weapons?
That's right. Zorob's going to start importing enriched uranium.
Yeah, his nuclear program is going to be one to monitor. There is some it's amazing how whiplash you can get. I remember like being on Saturday, like going from regime change tweets and mega posts from Trump to like the ceasefire thing. That was quite a whiplash there. Now there's reports out there about possibly the expansion of the Abraham Accords that could include not only Saudi Arabia, but also Syria, which would be a pretty big deal. There's already discussions out there about maybe sanctions relief for Iran. So again, it's there'll be a lot still to untangle there. The Middle East never lacks for content. But with that being said, this has been this week's edition of Power and Market. And a reminder, if you would like to hang out with Ryan, Connor, and myself in October, we've got our beautiful supporter summit in Delray Beach, Florida, featuring Jim Bovard, Guido Holzman, of course, the great Tom DeLorenzo, Tom Woods, Bob Murphy, and a variety of other MVPs, including Alex Pollock, who we mentioned earlier, and Bill Anderson. So yeah, all sorts of great hits there. You can do so. It will be October 16th through the 18th, again, down there in Delray Beach. You can find more about this at Mises.org/events. And make sure that you're subscribed to the Mises Wire email as well to get headlines, which will probably feature themselves in a future Power and Market episode in the future. For Connor O'Keefe, for Ryan McMakin, this is Tho Bishop. We'll see you next week. Proceed ever more boldly.